Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Hello, I'm going to do a fatal series, series of podcasts on induction, reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia. One article is called The Problem of Induction, and the second article is David Hume. They're both interlinked, and the big question is, why would you want to listen to and why would I want to talk about induction? And is there a problem with it, and do people have a problem with it? Well, induction is sort of like the as I breathe, I live. Induction is what a scientist does to do science. So you might say, look, I need a scientist qualification to run a reactor or to run a lab. But when they're running a lab, they're using science, they're using their qualification, but they're not actually doing science in that they're applying their scientific knowledge, but they're actually not doing science. Science is very much about, it may be thought of like producing apps for your mobile phone. Everyone can buy apps from the app store, and the app can actually interact and produce valuable information to you. It can scan a card, it can calculate these things, can switch on and off, and it uses technology, but the app itself doesn't do science. But those who write the app have to think about the existing knowledge base and take and do an experiment and develop something, and then that's a new piece of information, and that information goes in. And so the actual use of apps all the way there, but the actual writing of apps. And so scientists are very much in the same area. They want to actually seek out the edge of knowledge and extend the boundaries of it. Now, a lot of people, so we didn't always do that. We sort of had basically a realm of folk knowledge, sort of like a bubble of folk knowledge, and we would sort of ferment and work on it and improve it such that we'd do quality control on our existing basket of knowledge and raise that good quality knowledge up the top. And the idea is that if I have good quality knowledge and I apply that good quality knowledge consistently, I can actually divine junk knowledge from good knowledge, which is sort of a valid internal way of producing something. And it produced things, was able to pull things out of the pool of knowledge that we could apply it more effectively, but it really wasn't scientific thinking. And today, a lot of people wouldn't be able to write an app, and they wouldn't be able to do science, yet they definitely know what a good app is, and they know what good science is, and they can use both those things. So the vast majority of societies in the non-scientific, they're scientific users, but they're not scientific thinkers. And then every once in a while there comes a conflict that scientists in a process of they have a responsibility, in actual fact, an ethical responsibility to do no more harm or to do something which is benefit. It's sort of like a contract in that we provide security for them, resources, and in return they're to be an honest broker to advise us what we're doing wrong. And a real case in that would be global warming, in that scientists are beginning to take the data, the modelling, and they're starting to make hypotheses that use inductive logic. And as the inductive logic is coming through, it percolates from becoming inductive, it comes into the real scientific regime, and we can do deductive logic. And so people are seeing that, think, I don't really understand that, but I'm going to apply my methodology of folk science and say folk constructions. This is people, social reasoning, and saying, look, I'm the President of the United States. I have made several declarations in the past. My belief is solid because of my personality. It doesn't require what facts. And I'm going to mine coal and ignore the Paris Treaty. And this is for the good of the workers. Now, basically, one would say, well, the way that I can beat that argument is the argument is based on I'm strong, you can't beat me until you actually bash me up with a big army and destroy me. Whereas scientists would not go that far. They'd actually say, well, is this a logical one? You know, I can predict, use inductive logic to say, look, you're going to kill everyone on the planet, so your workers are not going to be better off because of it. But those, if you can imagine, that's a biplane, barn hopping, and a jet travelling in the stratosphere. The two don't really mix. And so the real thing is that the people down the grounds have a problem with induction, and they have a problem with knowledge. They use it. We use them to use their knowledge, which we train them by habitual things. So a lot of people know things only by habit. That is, they know ice is cold. It's obviously cold. This is an example from this encyclopedia. Ice is cold because I felt it cold in the past, and there's no reason not to think it. Well, there is actually no reason not to think it's hot in the future. Whereas the scientists will say, well, it's got the probability of solidity. The ice is solid, or if it's snow, it reflects light. And it's at a certain point, and I know due to the laws of thermodynamics, something hot is not going to be next to something cold, and so therefore I can do this deduction. I can deduce that something is hot on a scientific basis, and if it's not hot, I'll then drag out my inductive. So if it's not cold, I'll bring out my inductive engine and start to work out why the error is not, you just don't bump away from it. A scientist will actively pursue that and expand knowledge, and that glimmer of time, that's that fraction of a second where they're actually expanding knowledge, they're actually conducting science. But as said, the two things don't interact, and most people believe that they're speaking reasonably, but they're not speaking reasonably. They're speaking on the basis of habit, and it ultimately goes back to an authority. So, which is, unfortunately, this is the way the courts operate. At the end of the day, we have a standard of investigating things. We need an answer. You know, someone has killed someone. We need to find out whether someone's guilty or not. And so there are these social laws and social facts, and we've got this entire mechanism where eventually the poor person gets hanged, you know, the criminal gets hung based on the best evidence available across. But the evidence itself is the standard of evidence is this pre-scientific thing, is that it's been cold in the past, so I can make that conclusion into the future, or the conclusion for this, the cases of this criminal thing, and say definitively that happened. So we have to use this type of stuff, and our valuing things of money, law, and things like that are not scientifically based. So money is an agreed exchange. So there's a lot of value in this non-scientific stuff. And there's a lot of social force tied up in non-science. It's just at a point, how do you actually get in to actually look at the problem of reduction? And it's interesting to see how people can't access science. They will put it aside. They will introduce social reactions. They will put scientists down. They'll shut them out. They may even kill them. You know, there's, I think, Alec Guinness and the man in the white coat. this scientists, they just do not understand. A scientist, once they have tasted induction and logical and ability to think, they actually pull themselves away from society. And so and society thinks nothing of killing a scientist, getting rid of a scientist, getting rid of the climate change thing, shutting down the EPA, because that's how I deal with enemies. That's how I think. I think might is right. I think that if I am king, or what I say goes, and anyone who's against me gets crushed. And the thing is that you can kill scientists and you can shut down the EPA, but you can't actually affect the science. So it's actually ultimately a stupid thing to do. But these things go across, and scientists themselves have to really learn basically a strategy to deal with people who've got a non-scientific basis, people who look at something and their immediate reaction will be to produce blockages for it. Just very recently I showed a group of friends over that my new age boxes, new teaching box, which is wildly Internet of Things, will measure an experiment and do the temperature of the experiment, and eventually it will be way up over the top. So for under $100 it will measure 2 pressures, 6 temperatures, mass, down to the microgram, continuously on the internet, and they'll still say, well, I don't think anyone will pay $100 for that. They will buy something else from a store which they know with a brand name on it. They won't do it. Now, it's not that's negative, it's just that's the natural way of thinking. Oh, I don't want to change the way I think, so I have this natural discipline of mind. So the discipline of mind of a scientist is, oh, if they see something non-conforming, they say, oh, well, that has to, we have to get out of the armchair and I have to work on it. Whereas people who are in that non-scientific event, it's just far easier for them to push people away, to continue as it is, because if you look at them, their entire life is structured on it, their entire society is structured on it. So it's far easier for us just to continue building coal, wrecking the environment, because we've just done that. We've got this huge inertia here. And so this is my reasoning for reading this problem of induction. And it will be actually a very, very long read. And be very difficult for you to listen to. It's difficult enough for me to understand. And as I've said, it's in 2 sections. One is the problem of induction, and then the research into David Hume. So I've read the research into David Hume, just basically got through it, and then I've sort of like learned just to crawl, swim in a bay, and now I'm out into the ocean of the problem of induction. And although this is a philosophically nice thing, philosophers are really not aware of the scientist non-scientist conflict, where scientists have become prey of a society who is wanting to enjoy the fruits of science but not actually do any of the thinking associated with science. So this is an important sort of snapshot. A video of what could go on, a snapshot, just before science did, someone stood up and said, hey, this is the problem with all this folk thinking. And they stood up. Now, philosopher, this is just, well, that's an interesting thing. The philosophers have done many things, but for people in the fray, this is really interesting. Okay, so reading this, the problem, Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So Stanford was a railway magnate with lots of money in California, set up at Stanford University, and it's the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, the problem of induction, first published Wednesday, March 21, 2018. So it's not, not ancient, but it's not immediate. And induction means I have a hunch And then I don't know how I have the hunch. You may have several, and then you establish the quality of that hunch. So it's sort of like previously I've got a whole series of Christmas presents, and I sort of order them some good to junk to throw away. But I can now make my own Christmas presents by guessing it and actually assessing it. That's induction. It's a fantastic idea. Okay. Okay. And this is by Okay, well, I really can't understand it. It says, editor's note. The following new entry by Leah Henderson replaces the former entry on this topic by the previous author. So they've just looked at it, and it's obviously it's sort of like a Wikipedia page. It's beyond repair, and she's written it. But this is Birdswell. It's a woman speaking, and it's by a single author, so it's great. So reading into it, you generally think that the observations we make are able to justify some expectation or predictions about observations we have not yet made, as well as general claims that go beyond the observed. So, if I get some ice as a kid, I experience this, so I can generally expect that if I put ice on a in my soup, it will cool it down. And if I see, I suppose, if I see ice in a crater on the moon, I expect that it's always been cold. But for example, the observation of bread of a certain appearance as less than I've been nourishing seems to justify the expectation that the next similar piece of bread I eat will also be nourishing, as well as claims that the bread of this sort is generally nourishing. Such inferences from the observed to the unobserved, or to general laws, is known as inductive inferences. Okay, so what, if you can imagine, at this stage, these are bubble inferences. What we do nowadays is say, that's bread, and I have a certain reasoning, and I can reinforce the inferences besides just expectations. But before science, it was just that. You know, bread is nourishing. That is a fact. Now we know about the nutrients and the GI factors and the microbiome. We've got all this factors which can say. And then if someone's two people eat the same bread and one's starving, one's probably got stomach cancer or something like that. Okay, the original source of what has become known as the problem of induction is Book 1, Part 3, section of A Treatise of Human Nature by David Hume, published in 1739. In 1748, Hume gave a shorter version of the argument in Section 4 of An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. Throughout this article, we will give references to the treatise as T and the inquiry as E, the letter E. So this is basically it. At the dawn of the Enlightenment, or into it, so Newton died in the early 17, whatever it is. This is straight afterwards. So the Enlightenment's going to go into full swing, and this person is trying to say, is now commenting really about our common knowledge. So if I asked, I forgot to say, my wife, for instance, why is ice cold? She would say, it's cold because it's been in the fridge and I've got this experience. Whereas I would say that it feels cold because it's going to a lower entropy state and removing heat from the environment, and I'd have a mechanism behind it. So statistically, there's only one state which is cold, you know, probably cold. There are many states in the water state, many configurations. So statistically, it's going to melt, and it goes through like this. Or I'd go through a mechanism. It, you know, things appear cold on your hand. Water appears cold if you wet a towel and put it in your head. Evaporation is going. And what happens is I've got three particles, and they come together to eject a third of the three particles of average energy. They eject a third particle at high energy, high entropy, and leaving the two colder. It's sort of like a snooker process where you, it's sort of like in reverse. If you imagine you've got a ball and you are firing it at high speed into the three balls will roll off together. Now I can reverse this and have a ball go off, and so what will happen, and if I put a boundary, the energy boundary, say the particle leaving us, so this is all is hot, it will therefore leave coolness there, and the entropy is increased. So there's all this new scientific thing which happens, Boltzmann and stuff like that, the scientists start to talk about. But your common sense thing, he's talking here, this is very much talking to the common person, your common person saying, why is gravity? And that gravity is a pretty intense thing, is that Newton's inspiration was to actually, by force of personality, whatever it is, put in inductively, like the inductive process really hadn't really got going. He said, this is a law of nature. There you go, law of nature. Doesn't say anything. Everyone says, why do things fall? And they eventually go down, eventually just say, oh, Newton said it would. Yeah. And things, observe things fall. We now know that the space causes the space to curve, and there's the Higgs boson and all this type of stuff. But before this point in time, before we could possibly know that, the best we had was this inductive method of doing it, and it was a very effective one, because it meant that you would be careful putting very heavy things on a flimsy shelf, and it might fall over and kill you. Okay, the next paragraph, and we'll get through there. Hume asks on what grounds we come to our beliefs about the unobserved on the basis of inductive inferences. So, if I see a cloud, is it going to be cold or not? And inductively, or go up in the clouds. He presents an argument in the form of a dilemma which appears to rule out the possibility of any reasoning from premises to the conclusion of an inductive inference. That is, that it's the act of induction does not have reason with it. And look, I would tend to agree. I think the actual act of induction doesn't have reasons, but the next processes after that do involve reasons, and that people, I suppose, use inductive, non-scientists use induction, but they don't follow scientific processes after it. That's what I would expect. And therefore, because they don't use scientific processes for induction, they think they can't recognize the difference in quality going ahead. There are, he says, two possible types of arguments, demonstrative and probable, but neither will serve. So he's saying this, categorized it up, and let's fear. And I've read this stuff and I've really got it in my head. A demonstrative argument produces the wrong kind of conclusion. A probable argument would be circular. Therefore, for Hume, the problem remains how to explain why we form any conclusions that go beyond the past instances which we've had experiences. So we're going to have to go back in what demonstrative and probable are. So just a sneak preview. One is to do with mathematical reasoning, and the other one is to do with experiential reasoning, staying the world the way the world is, having read it, but I couldn't tell you which one is both. Oh yeah, I think the way the world is that I can only say it's more probable that this will be so, and demonstrative one is basically fixed in a circular, the number of degrees in a triangle. Hume stresses that he's not disputing that we do draw such inferences, which is, of course we do, except non-scientific people do, and they don't realise it's non-scientific. The challenge, as he sees it, is to understand the foundation of the inference. the logical process of argument that is based upon. The problem of meeting this challenge while evading Hume's arguments against the possibility of doing so has become known as the problem of induction. So there is a bit of a scientific question, and it's good for scientists to know, and we really need to explain this to non-scientists. Hume's argument is one of the most famous in philosophy. And, well, there you go. You're onto something famous in philosophy. So philosophers should be able to talk about it. A number of philosophers have attempted solutions to the problem, but a significant number have embraced his conclusion that it is insoluble. And I'm sort of standing on the cusp of that. I think the actual process itself, the instant of induction, is probably insoluble. Or not. It obviously, I think artificial intelligence can make inductions and stuff like that. But I don't think you can actually put a simple... It's a neural process rather than something which is discrete. That's what I think. But I do think the processes that proceed from it and your awareness of how it does, that's where science comes in. So I use induction to learn about my world, to learn that, I know a cat. Animals do it. Like a kitten, I've watched kittens a couple of times when they first run... Say I'm going through a mirror, a window, they will automatically just trot along and go boomf ahead, and they know that they've learnt that, and they, you could say that the cat no longer going through the mirror, it's a process of induction, going through a window, trying to walk through a window, that's a process of induction, whereas scientists learning new things and contributing to sort of a communal. So I think that's another aspect that scientists, there's a scientific candor and a group of sort of communal logic for it all. Hume's argument is, there is also a wide spectrum of opinion on the significance of the problem. Some have argued that Hume's argument does not establish any far-reaching skeptical conclusion, either because it was never intended to, or because the argument is some way misformulated. I think it's true that it's not got great impact, but I think that's in our peril, because we inevitably, like if you look at who is burning coal... Who is hunting animals? Who is doing all the damage? You could say collectively the human race, or you could say people who really haven't understood Hume's induction thing. I think, without being moralistic or judgmental, I do think this is probably more important than religion as a way to being good and low impact on the planet. Yet, it may be regarded as one of the most profound philosophical challenges imaginable, since it seems to call into question the justification of the most fundamental ways which we form knowledge. Bertrand Russell, who is just my saviour of mathematics, for example, expressed the view that if Hume's problems cannot be solved, there is no intellectual difference between sanity and insanity. Isn't that beautiful? Which, I think, is a problem in that... Can I say that that's a view that there's no difference between a scientist and a non-scientist, sane and insanity? So really, when you count it down to the end of it, the act of excluding another human from a group because you don't like them is not scientific. It's just a deeply pre-programmed thing. So now... This is really interesting to see, and I will look at Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell is of our times. He was an anti-nuclear protester. In this article, we will first examine Hume's own argument, provide a reconstruction of it, and then survey different responses to the problem which it poses. Okay, so there's 7 sections, and about about 30 subsections, seven or probably 20 subsections. Oh, 30 subsections. So it's a big read. Just see how far you're going, how much we're going. But we're 30 minutes in. I might do an hour on this. Okay, Hume's problem. Hume, so David Hume, a sort of, you've got to sort of understand, he couldn't make it in academia because he was a bit of an atheist, and the academics at this stage were strictly religious. And that's probably unfair. And so it meant that he was a librarian. And it's interesting, the number of people like that. You've got Priestley, you've got Einstein, who was a patent clerk. Leibniz was a librarian. There's a lot of these people who don't make it into mainstream academia or get rejected from it. So it's interesting about this. Hume introduces the problem of induction as part of an analysis of the notions that of cause and effect. This is basically what philosophy is about, or how we structure that in your head. Hume worked with a picture widespread in the early modern period in which the mind was populated with mental entities called ideas. This is really interesting in that we now, you say that the mind has got thousands of ideas and my thought manipulates different ideas together. So it's interesting to read it. And it's interesting to know that, yeah, I don't know, we don't think, it's hard to say, like, when you get on in life, you've got strokes and stuff like that, you sort of release your less important the ideas. And I suppose it's the other thing that if you have an idea, people do not value it. If someone is powerful, got an idea, well, we can work with that to get money and value out of it. But if you're insignificant, your ideas are insignificant. Hume thought that ultimately all our ideas would be traced back to impressions, a sense of experience. So I think, just going for the other one, when I eat a red apple, my first eating of it is sensory in so many ways, the crispness, the redness, the taste, and those impressions are not ideas, but eventually that formulates my idea of an apple, which is fundamentally different from Plato, who believed that the ideas existed in space before. You know, this is the idea of form. So the idea very much would be Plato's form, and ideas predate impressions, and impressions are inaccurate copies of an idea or form. In the simplest case, an idea enters the mind by being copied from the corresponding impression. More complex ideas are then created in the combination of simple ideas. Hume took there to be a number of relations between ideas, including the relation of causation. For more on Hume's philosophy in general, see Morris and Brown, 2014. So it is worth reading. For Hume, the relation of causation is the only relation for which we can go beyond the evidence of our memory and senses, which is true. So, you know, what causes the apple? Well, it grows on the tree, and, you know, I paid money for it. Might be one reason. Suppose we have an object presented to our senses, say gunpowder. We may infer an effect to the object, say an explosion. The causal relation links our past and present experiences to our expectations about the future. And this is very much so that that's a brown, sorry, black powder. It's copper, sorry, carbon, sulfur, which is your oxygen form, and nitrate, which is your accelerant. You mix it together, so that I'll be able to reason that that's explosion. My expectation of any powder, so of anything, would be on the chemical stability of it. Which is science, but pre-science, the only way you could work out whether something is bang is to go through everything and light everything and work it out. Hume argues we cannot make causal inferences by purely a priori means. Rather, that which is what scientists can actually do, they can measure the components of things and deduce with the supercomputer what's going on. Rather, he claims, it's based on... Hello, darling?
Yes.
It's based on experience, and specifically experience of constant conjunction. That is, I've seen it once, it always happens. There's no exception. So conjunction is a very interesting term. So Newton used it when he said, I suppose, mass and acceleration are conjunct for it. We infer that gunpowder will explode on the basis of past experience of association between gunpowder and explosion. Hume wants to know more about the basis of this kind of inference. If such an inference is made by a chain of reasoning, he says, he would like to know what the reasoning is. In general, he claims, the inferences depend on a transitional of the form. So I wonder what that actually means. So let's go back again. That Descartes, who's obviously earlier, but not a lot earlier, a few hundred years earlier, said that philosophy is an unbroken chain of reasoning. So we're not going, Descartes, and you, it can't be broken. And I think, try to think of this Jesuit person called Insight. Insight, he said that there's a series of philosophers who look about the chain of reasoning, and what's his name? Bernard Lonergan. There you go. So my brain mustn't be as fried with holes. I can get it going. Bernard Lonergan said, and it's Insight, it's something well worth reading. It's sort of like, if you've enjoyed the Summa Theologica, you will enjoy Bernard Lonergan's Insight, because it's sort of a similar dialectical form going through, but really intense. It's really enjoyable. But he said that scientists must account for all facts, and this is something which is not in here, that I must be able to account for all instances, universal instances. So this is more a methodical process. He's sort of looking up and saying there's a larger process, and I'm in this case looking back and saying that, you know, this is the way we're talking about, the way non-scientists think. Okay. Hume wants to know more about the basis of inference. For such an inference is made by a chain of reasoning. He says he would like to know what the reasoning is. In general, he claims the inference depends on a transition of the form. I found, and this is a quote from him, I found that such an object has always been attended with such an effect, and I foresee that other objects which are in appearance similar will be attended with similar effects. Okay, so this is just uncritical observation that it's got explosives written on it, and it's black powder, I think, will be like that, sort of like icing sugar and cocaine, you know. Okay, in the treatise T, I would suspect, Hume says, if reason determined, apostrophe S, us, it would proceed upon that principle that instances for which we have no experience must resemble those in which we have had an experience, and that the course of nature continues always uniformly the same. You know, now, this is the idea, this fundamental thing that I expect, you know, that in my universe, in my world, and, you know, the course of nature continuing the same, is this type of reasoning which we use to actually kill people, you know, slap fine some people. You if you don't do it, we ultimately say this reason is so powerful that we can punish people for not following it. So, for convenience, we'll refer to this claim of similarity or resemblance between the observed and unobserved regularities as the uniformity principle, UP. Sometimes it's also called the resemblance principle, or the principle of uniformity of nature. Now, this is what everyone uses. Now, if you use that, and you don't have these other components in play, you won't naturally be a scientist. And a lot of people just don't get science, because I know it already, you know, what's going on. Hume then presents his famous argument to the conclusion that there can be no reasoning behind this principle. I think practically day-to-day, I think that's right, but then we've got discovery of the fundamental particles, Bose, and stuff, fundamental physics. For me, the argument takes the form of a dilemma. Okay, so just remember that he's got two types of things. He's got the demonstrative and, probable inference. I don't quite understand what it is. Hume makes the distinction between relations of ideas and matters of fact. Okay, so I think, what is an idea? Relations of ideas include geometric, algebraic, and arithmetic propositions, and, in short, every affirmation which is either intuitively or demonstrably certain. Okay, so my idea of a triangle, my system of ideas, so this is axiomatic knowledge of maths. So maths has the greatest number of conclusions that you can draw from the minimum number of axioms. So if you look at things, but you can still use induction to get something up, and then you have the work of a mathematician is to remove induction from it. That's a process for it. So if I think of a new mathematical fact, like the frequency of numbers, like Fermat's theorem or conjecture, I eventually will move it from inductive phase back into the deductive realm. So it's a very short process, which is true for all science. Induction is something which occurs only fleetingly. It's something which is really enjoyable, and it's sort of a view, it's an intense little reflective thing, but after you've done induction, it eventually will toil up, and it means that you might do an induction about, say, a black hole or something like that. Eventually it's Higgs bosons, waves and stuff like that, it will eventually settle down. Okay, let's go back. Matters of fact, on the other hand, are empirical propositions that can easily be conceived to be other than they are. Hume says that. Now, this is interesting. So, if I say, I don't know, in the article I say about the location of cities, you know, where one city is north or south of the other, but you can actually, it's not something that you reason, it's something that you, it's not something that I don't reason that I don't know, get so much money for doing something like that. There's no reason for it. There's no logical reason for it. Where you come from? All reason may be divided into two kinds, namely demonstrative reasoning concerning the relations of ideas and moral reasoning concerning matters of facts and existence. So we get that. So that would be demonstrative reasoning and demonstrative induction, and there's probable induction. So Hume considers the possibility of each of these types of reasonings in turn, and each case argues that it is impossible for it to be a supplied argument of uniformity principle. It's only saying the uniformity principle goes ahead, and I think ultimately, say, we say about our universe, you know, we are looking to the, we're looking for the uniformity principle. We've looked right across, measured the fine structure constant everywhere in the universe. Everything, the universe appears to be one gigantic Higgs field. So uniformity principle for us is something experimentally measured up. First, Hume argues that reasoning cannot be demonstrative, because demonstrative reasoning only establishes conclusions which cannot be conceived to be false. Yeah, so really it's like someone gets up to talk about the holiday and they have been on holiday, or I don't know quite how you say it. And he says, it implies no contradiction that a course of nature may change, and that an object, like those which we have experienced, may be attended with different or contrary effects. So, yeah. So I can sort of see it's outside your inductive reasoning. Although I think in maths you can use inductive logic, but only it's inductive logic. It's sort of in an unstable state. It's possible, he says, to clearly and distinctly conceive a situation where the unobserved case does not follow the regularity so far observed. Second, it is possible to say, well, that's a bit hard for me to understand. I think, it's possible to clearly, distinctly think, so I can only think of triangles with 180 degrees inside it, because otherwise it's just a triangle is a what is it? It's a it's like subroutines. A triangle is a subroutine for this. It calls it up. It's not a triangle. Doesn't add no further information to 180 degrees within. Angles within. Second, Hume argues that reasoning cannot be, quote, such as regard matter of fact and real experience. He also calls this a probable reasoning, which all such reasonings, he claims, proceeds upon the supposition that the future is conformable to the past. In other words, the uniformity principle. So, you can't derive the uniformity principle by example, like the uniformity principle appears to be true because of the uniformity principle, especially the circular. Therefore, if the chain of reasoning is based on an argument of this kind, it's relying on this supposition and taking that for granted, which is the very point of the question. The second type of reason then fails to provide a chain of reasoning which is not non-circular. Well, I can agree with that. So, it's except science is obviously going in between it. So I think, you know, as you can think, I think Antarctica is rimmed with ice because it's always been rimmed with ice. Therefore, my way of reasoning that it's rimmed with ice is it's always rimmed with ice. It's sort of, and therefore, that's an example of the uniformity principle. I can definitely see it, because scientists are looking for breaches in the uniformity principle, and then they fix it up. You know, if something doesn't work, they modify the science, so it's there. In the treatise version, which is there's E and T, quote, this not only our reason fails in the discovery of the ultimate connection for causes and effects, but even after experiences informed us of their constant conjunction, it is impossible for us to satisfy ourselves by our reason. Why should we extend that experience beyond the particular instances which have fallen under our observation? Okay, so I can sort of see what he's saying, but I think, you know, so many hundred years later, what are we? 200, what, this 50 to 80, yeah, 300 years later, I do think we've got a fair amount of science, except what's happened is the vast majority of society has gone off on one tangent, looking at it, and scientists have gone off, like, we've separated on paths. I think this is the linking idea behind it. It's a way that we could talk to non-scientists and sort of talk them across. The conclusion, then, is that our tendency to project the past regularities into future is not underpinned by reason. The problem of induction is to find a way to avoid this conclusion despite Hume's arguments. Okay, and we know that this is actually not resolved. After presenting the problem, Hume does present his own solution to doubts that he's raised. E5T 13.17 to 16. There you go. This consists of an explanation for what inductive inferences are driven by, if not reason. In the treatise, Hume raises the problem of induction in an explicitly contrastive way. He asks whether the transition involved in inference is produced. Now, for education, this is important in that ultimately, if it's not something we can mark, induction is not something we can mark, it is imagination. It's a whole lot of other things besides, as well as intelligence. And I think this is making us really lopsided in the way we teach science. Quote, by means of understanding or imagination, we are determined by reason to make the transition, or that a certain association relations of perceptions, I don't understand that. He goes on to summarize the conclusion by saying, when the mind therefore passes from idea or impression of one object to an idea or belief of another, it's not determined by reason, but by certain principles which associate together the ideas of these objects and unite them in imagination. Thus, it is imagination that is taken to be responsible for underpinning the inductive inference rather than reason. And essentially, people make a living out of understanding Einstein. Einstein made a living out of being Einstein, and he tried in vain to describe the imagination and rational thought going in his head. Everyone else said, I can't do it, which really doesn't advance the situation, does it? You know, there's a figure skater trying to explain how they figure skate, and people say, I can't stand on ice. And they walk away, sort of like this amazing thing. In the inquiry, Hume suggests that the step taken by the mind, quote, which is not supported by any argument or process or understanding, must be induced by some other principle of equal weight and authority. The principle is custom or habit. The idea that if one has seen similar objects or similar constantly conjoined, then the mind is inclined to expect similar regularity to hold in future. This tendency or propensity to draw such inferences is the effect of custom, which goes well way to the level that we teach by transferring custom, but we don't transfer custodianship of custom. That's my view. Okay, here's a big quote. Having found in many instances that two kinds of objects, flame and heat, snow and cold, have always been co-joined together, if flame or snow be presented anew to the senses, the mind is carried to the custom expected of heat and cold, and to believe that such quantity does exist and will discover itself upon near approach. This belief is necessary result of placing the mind in such circumstances. It is an operation of the soul that when we are so situated as unavoidable as to feel a passion of love, we receive benefits, or hatred when we meet with injuries. All these operations are a species of natural instincts, which no reasoning or process or thought and understanding is able to either to produce or to prevent, which ultimately is, you know, having children is, what is that about? What is the logic of that? It's very much driven to it. But for a woman, it's very high risk, isn't it? Okay, Hume argues that the fact that these inferences do follow the course of nature is a kind of, quote, pre-established harmony. It is a kind of natural instinct which, in fact, be more effective in making us successful in the world than if we are relied on reason to make these inferences, i.e. that we're imbued with a quick animal wit, which is basically beating another animal. You know, essentially, we have evolved to outcompete other humans and other animals. We've been an arms race, and then what's happened is this arms race of logic has changed. So we're on to this next chapter called Reconstruction, which we'll have to go through. It seems rather a deep thought. So that was a light introduction. This next one, Reconstruction, is going to be pretty mega major. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.